You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko mele toki ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rātū Tuesday. I'm your host Millie and I'll be with you along for the next hour alongside my producers Beth and Rosetta. E whaiaki nei coming up on the show. On Dear Science, Joel Rindelob comes in for his final appearance on the show before packing up and going to the University of Waikato. He'll be chatting to us about bias. Jess has a catch-up with Dr. Shane Reddy and they talk about the housing growth plan, as well as the Nationals' opposition to keeping the current retirement age. Beth, what have you got for us today?
I've done a report on the climate change march in Tamaki Makaurau, which happened on Friday.
Amazing. And Rosetta, what have you got for us today?
It's Samoan Language Week, so I've interviewed Rina from the University of Auckland Samoan Students Association, as well as AUT Pro Vice-Chancellor Pacific, Jakoba Matoba.
Hia ha whakaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātui mai, text in on 5395, or wai mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. As per usual, you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now, sad last year science, so we're going to go straight into that now.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hi, Joel.
Kia ora.
Kia ora, Joel.
How are we feeling?
Just gutted. Last Dear Science for me.
Absolutely. We are so sad to see you go.
Same here. It's going to be tough, you know, every Tuesday at noon not talking about dolphin clitorises.
Really, really hard. That's hard-hitting stuff. No, we will dearly miss you, but you are wearing a BFM hat.
Yes, I got a very nice parting gift from the staff here, and now I get to rock BFM everywhere I go.
Beamerch, University Campus. I'm pretty sure you can buy it online, too.
You can.
Yeah. Look as cool as Joel.
Fun story. I recently purchased a new vehicle.
Really?
And the radio station was BFM. And I haven't changed it since.
No. And nor should you.
Yeah, what's the point?
Keep it on the beat.
That was so in sync. That was telepathic. Now, we got you that hat because we like you. Because we're potentially biased.
Whoa.
Towards you. So, what is this about bias?
Bias. It exists.
No.
So even if you think you have no biases, you're wrong.
True.
You're absolutely wrong. And we can't address said biases unless we accept that we have them.
No.
Okay.
So that's the moral of the story for today. But I'm going to walk through a couple different recent studies that have looked at things like biases. So the first one that I would like to bring up, because, well, I guess it is an election year, but fake news.
Ooh.
Oh.
That's a big one.
Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah. It's giving me 2020 flashbacks.
Yeah, I'm getting them all at once.
Yes. But get ready for more of it because it's never ending. And so what these researchers at the University of Southern California wanted to find out is, why do people share fake news?
Yeah, why do they?
Really good question. So some people would say, all right, well, if you're sharing news that's fake, they're not a great critical thinker, right? Or maybe they have political biases.
True.
But this recent study actually had a bit more to say, and it found that the largest factor for sharing fake news was actually the reward system built into social media.
You are kidding me. Oh, well, I guess the bigger the splash, the more of a reaction.
Exactly. So just like how video games are designed to give you some sort of reward system, social media also designed to give you those likes, those loves, and...
Comment section. Yeah.
So what they did is they looked at over 2,400 active Facebook users, and they found that the people, the habitual users, the heavy users, shared disproportionately the most misinformation, the most fake news.
Wow, that's interesting.
It is interesting. And what was even more interesting is that, you know, sometimes they would actually share fake news that was politically discordant with their own personal beliefs. So it didn't matter necessarily if it was super conservative or super liberal. The people that were most active, that were sharing the most, didn't seem to care. They just wanted to keep sharing.
They just wanted the attention.
They just wanted the attention. But the good news is that in this study, they basically were able to trial out some ways to combat that, and they found that if their reward system is based on accuracy, so like if you get more reward for sharing accurate information, it actually doubled the amount of real news that was shared.
Oh, that's great, because I was about to be like, how do we fight this? I mean, we're all members of the news team on The Wire, and so it's just horrific, the thought of fake news. I'm shuddering. No, that is interesting. So the more reward attached to accurate information results in more accurate.
It's all about the reward system, it turns out. Unfortunately, at the moment, social media companies are very much based on popularity.
Yeah.
So that's the reward-based system, is how many shares you get, how many comments. They don't really care if it's accurate or not. They just want those clicks, which, of course, is in line with their business model. And maybe a reason why they haven't done this reward system based on accuracy is because it actually limits people share less if they have to go through this step and check it for accuracy.
I guess it's more important than ever that we're informed and able to apply our critical thinking skills, and yet the most difficult time than ever to do so, you know, we're getting this constant influx of bullshit, for lack of a better word.
Great word.
How do we tell what's
real and what's fake?
Yeah.
Well, there are some tips that you can abide by. One being, check the source.
Yeah, indeed.
Check the source. Of course, top of the pyramid for most trusted source would be peer-reviewed literature. But of course, there are other types of sources as well as respected news agencies and articles where they actually do interview experts and get quotes rather than something that might be from personal opinion. Mm. So unfortunately, you might have to click that link and read the article rather than just the headline.
Oh, no. No, just kidding. We can do that for the good of society. Would it take working with social media outlets to put in place a new reward system?
So that's where there are some academics that believe that some sort of regulation might be needed to kind of instill these types of reward systems that are based on accuracy rather than, say, popularity.
So there's currently no regulation system?
Currently, no. Not for this particular type of sharing regulation.
Bummer. Well, now we know how to spot it. Go to the experts, stay with them, they'll tell you the truth.
That's right. And you can always use something like factcheck.org or Snopes, which will do all this legwork for you if you're curious about a particular article or subject.
Gonna bookmark it on my browser.
Click, click, click. That is amazing. And you've got some stories here for us.
I've got more stories. And
got some yarns about implicit bias.
Implicit biases. Yeah, not a super exciting topic, I'm aware, but important.
Could be fun.
Could be fun. All right, so we're going to take you all the way back to 2020 again. And
oh, no.
I know everyone has kind of mentally repressed it, but we're going to take just a bit of a dive because it was breeding ground for biases and the news on social media, and especially relating to COVID. So vaccines, treatments like ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, some things much more effective than others. And so this study in our favorite journal, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, otherwise known as PNAS.
Oh, I knew that one, but I was like, is it too early in the day? All right, what did PNAS say? There you go.
So what they did is they actually looked at critical care physicians, so aka doctors, and they gave them a theoretical case of like a patient that had COVID, and they basically asked for their political inclinations as well as what their news sources were, and then they looked at how they would treat this person to see if there were any political biases. Turns out, yes.
They were.
Even amongst experts themselves, there was a political bias to treat with some of these lesser effective treatments like the old hydroxychloroquine drug or ivermectin. Now, of course, the bias was, of course, much less pronounced than compared to the general lay people, the general public. So experts overall were better, but those that leaned very far right, so very conservative, actually were in disagreement on these treatments compared to, or more likely to be in disagreement compared to those that were leaning far left or moderates. And so what they did is they, for instance, gave them a breakdown of the drug ivermectin that was critical of how it might not actually be effective in treating COVID. Mm. And so they did it blind without mentioning the drug name. And so they found that pretty much everyone was in agreement. But when they unblinded it and it had the term ivermectin in it, those that were the most far-right conservative that would watch cable news as their source of information actually had a different opinion of that breakdown of the drug.
That is so interesting. Could you just change the name? Or is that off the cards?
This isn't ivermectin. What are you talking about?
So this is important that we do have biases. And again, there's just things that we need to accept before we can try to acknowledge and basically move forward. So political bias, not the only type of bias out there. There's also a very pronounced gender bias.
No way. I never knew.
Well, it might be because you were biased.
Maybe.
So this was a study that was done at Colorado State University. And so what they did is they took uni students in STEM, science, technology, engineering, maths. And what they found is that the female students actually outperformed the male. Better marks.
Mm.
Higher chance of getting an A plus.
Girl power.
Girl power.
Tuesday Wire, girl power.
It's real. But here's the thing. Both men and women in the class identified the males as presumed to be the best students.
Oh, no. That is so interesting.
I love society.
Society. So what was their reasoning? Like, were they asked to give reasoning?
For this particular study, it was just a survey where, unfortunately, they didn't get to break down where these biases originate. And that's something, of course, that is going to be for further study. But there's also, in other classes, like the life sciences, where the females were actually outnumbered the males in these classes, actually had a similar type of relationship where the females in the class were not necessarily seen as the best resources for this information, the best students.
Well, that's shocking. How do we help that along?
Right. So, I mean, people kind of assume that if we have a more equitable distribution of men and women in these STEM classes, that's going to solve bias problems. But this study has blatantly told us that there's more that needs to be done.
Yeah, there's something on a deeper level. And you'd just hope that the, you know, professors and teachers and things aren't biased as well.
And so that's why, again, we need to accept that it's our personal responsibility to try to acknowledge these biases. And so, yeah. I mean, some tips to do that is you can try to think of people as individuals rather than, you know, part of a larger group. You know, try to think of someone that is maybe from a stereotype group that doesn't fit that description. That can help break some of these internal biases. Try to think of things from another person's perspective. Try to walk a life in their shoes, for instance. And of course, increasing contact from other social groups, again, can help break down some of these implicit biases.
Totally. So work on it, listeners. All of us have to.
We're all in this together.
Would you aim for a world of zero bias, or does a little make it go round? Who knows?
It's got to be asked.
I don't know if we'll ever be able to totally eliminate biases.
No, sadly. Yeah, just as sad as you leaving. How could you?
I am also quite sad, but the Wire will survive. Dear Science will survive. It's in great hands with a great team, and you're going to keep on crushing it.
Exactly. Well, thank you for all your time over the years, all the dolphins we've discussed, all the science. Thank you, Motet. Thank you, Joel, very much. And thank you, Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
One Spider-Man wants to change his own destiny.
This is my chance to prove myself.
Miles Morales returns for the next Spider-Man movie.
Spider-Man, Across the Spider-Verse.
Everyone keeps telling me how my story is supposed to go.
Nah, I'ma do my own thing.
Spider-Man is catapulted across the multiverse and must redefine what it means to be a hero.
And then I looked at my uncle and...
Let me guess, he died?
No. Spider-Man, Across the Spider-Verse, based on the Marvel comic books.
Starts Thursday only in cinemas.
Round of I Spot, anyone?
I Spot? Yeah, sure.
Let's go.
All right. I Spot with my little eye something beginning with... B.
Bar.
No.
Best mates?
No.
Beverages?
No.
Big dogs?
Yeah, those big dogs.
Come on, you know what it is.
Beersies!
The Beer Spot. With 40 delicious Beersies on tap and 5 locations Auckland-wide, The Beer Spot is your tappy place. For opening hours and to find out more, head to thebeerspot.co.nz.
On Friday the 26th of May, I started in Victoria Park and ended up outside Auckland Council's offices on Wellesley Street. People carried signs reading, "No votes on a dead planet, climate justice now, and tax the rich." Among those attending were MP for Auckland Central Chloe Swarbrick and Green Party leaders Marama Davidson and James Shaw, as well as climate activist India Logan Riley. I asked James and India why it was important that we were there today.
I think, you know, it's an election year. And there are literally thousands of people in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland and around the country who are still displaced as a result of those floods and storms that we had earlier in the year. And I just think it's really important that we keep the attention on climate change whilst, you know, people are obviously worried about the cost of living and all of those other things. We cannot afford to take our eye off the ball.
It's really important when decision makers are making bad decisions that we show up in a variety of ways. Tell them how to do better and demand that they do better. So it's really important to do things like protest and strike because that really brings people's presence and demands to decision makers when they've found so many other convenient ways to not listen to them.
What would you demand of the council?
First of all, no cuts in the budget. We shouldn't be losing early childhood education centres and community gardens, advice bureaus, our festivals like Pacifica and Holly Fest. Those are all at risk of being cut right now for no reason. We know where to find the money, so yeah, no to the cuts, no to the Auckland Airport share sales. It doesn't make sense to sell something that is making you money.
Yeah.
Which would ultimately selling that would make us poorer. Probably just not make ourselves poorer under bad decision making.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course that we can raise rates and we can borrow in order to meet the needs. And of course, Auckland Council just won a court case that introduces a tourist tax. And so there are lots of other revenues and ways that we have to be able to find financial resources, as well as ask the central government to come through for Auckland as well. Like, mm-hmm. a quarter of the country's population lives here.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say that we should be getting more central support as well.
100%. Thank you.
In Ponake, Wellington, over 1,000 protesters marched to Parliament, demanding a reduction in Aotearoa emissions, a transition to regenerative agricultural practices, bringing the voting age down to 16, and to look at and consider tangata whenua first and foremost when responding to and making decisions surrounding climate change. In Tamaki Makaurau, speeches commenced outside Auckland Council and the event ended...
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
The National Party's Housing Minister, Chris Bishop, has announced a new housing policy which will see councils in major towns and cities to zone for the next 30 years' worth of growth. Today, Jess had a catch-up with National Party's Dr. Shane Retty, and they discussed a housing growth plan as well as having a quick check-in on where the party stands on not changing the retirement age. Here's that piece now.
So why have you now changed your mind on this policy?
So we received a lot of feedback that the housing accord was too prescriptive and councils wanted more flexibility. And we always said we'd be open to sensible changes that still deliver an increase in housing. And so clearly the policy needed to change because housing at the moment, I don't think anyone would say that housing is going well for us here in New Zealand. Not when we have rents up 160 a week since 2017, social housing wait list has increased by 20,000, there's thousands of families living in motels, housing is still not working. And so we just don't believe that the housing accord is still fit for purpose. So we've proposed a completely new policy.
Can you explain how your policy would give councils more autonomy over where they deliver this new housing?
So there's three parts to the newly announced house policy, that housing growth plan that we've announced. The first part is unlocking land for housing. So what we've said is that councils will be required to immediately zone 30 years of future demand in their region, anticipate where housing will be required, and zone 30 years going forward of supply. And what that also means is that they'll be able to opt out. One of the hurdles to that has been the medium density residential zone law. So councils will be able to opt out of that. So first of all, unlocking land. Secondly, infrastructure. The Infrastructure Funding and Financing Act will be reformed. And what that will do is that will allow targeted rates on greenfields, so new houses that are being built in new areas, will be able to have targeted rates. And what that will do is that will relieve some of the pressure on councils to fund infrastructure, water, electricity, fibre I put into that now, through their balance sheet, that can now come from targeted rates. And the third and final part to the housing plan is incentives for councils. A $1 billion fund for Build for Growth incentive, which fundamentally says that if a council, for every house above the five-year average that a council delivers or is participatory in, that there'll be $25,000 from this fund. So it's an incentive for councils to collaborate with developers, to collaborate with the sector to build houses.
Who do you believe this policy would benefit most?
This benefits those Kiwis, those people who are wanting to get on the property ladder. They will benefit the most because, and those who are renting, by the way, which is the same group, because they're just finding there is not enough supply, just simply not enough houses, which is putting houses beyond their reach. And so we believe it will be those New Zealanders who are currently renting, wanting to get on the property ladder, and those who desperately need homes. That's where the target audience is. Build more homes.
How would National address the need for more affordable housing in our major cities?
social housing providers, we think they can do a better job than government in many places because they're more agile, they've got different tools, and they're not encumbered by some of the sluggishness that happens with state-generated houses. So we're very supportive of social housing providers, and they'll reap all these benefits that we've announced in this policy will be directly applicable to them.
ACT initially opposed this policy when it was first introduced, and they've stated that it shows that they should be in a government. Do you believe that come the election, depending on the results, that you would be able to have a relationship with ACT in government?
Look, I have no doubt that that we can work with ACT, you know, what their policies are is for them, so I'm not going to comment on what they choose to make as a policy announcement. But I think we've heard very clearly from the leader that we can definitely work with ACT. But it's hypothetical, you know, in front of us here at the moment, what we need to do is get through to the election. We need to have this contest of ideas around policies. And we need to show what the government is offering and what the alternative is. And our housing plan is an alternative.
I also wanted to talk to you about your new superannuation policy. So the government has confirmed that it would keep the superannuation age at 65, as well as continue making contributions to the New Zealand Super Fund and providing the winter energy payment if re-elected. Why would National move to increase the superannuation age?
Well, we think this is very hypocritical from Chris Hipkins because we have to imagine in 2017, 2018, he was campaigning on raising the superannuation age. And I put it to you now, have things got better from then to now financially? Probably not. Our debt has gone up and yet the government wants to maintain the superannuation age. It was kind of interesting. It struck me that over the weekend, their much vaunted Congress, most of their announcements were what they would not do rather than what they would. And I think the electorate is looking to say, well, that's fine. That's what you won't do. But what will you do? Look, we're of a view, and Bill English put this into public domain, first of all, around about 17, 18, actually, that to be fiscally sustainable, we need to look at slowly raising the superannuation age to 67 over a long period of time to be fiscally sustainable and to start coming in line with some of our OECD partners like Australia. And so we're not afraid of this policy, one that we think is appropriate for the long-term future of New Zealand, and we're committed to doing that.
The latest advice from Treasury, like you said, is that the number of New Zealanders heading towards retirement would lead to an unsustainable level of debt. Is this advice guiding your policy?
Look, we've all known that the tsunami of older people, as we're blessed to be living longer, it also puts a lot of stress on the infrastructure, be it around health, be it around social services, but actually on the pension age as well. So we've certainly taken into account that increasing age group and what the fiscal implications would be for the affordability of superannuation.
When we were discussing the budget last week, you claimed that the Treasury's advice that the budget wouldn't be inflationary was not correct. Why do you think that they're right this time?
Oh, a number of commentators. I mean, every commentator was expecting a more restrained budget. In effect, it became a blowout budget. So everyone's kind of shocked as to how much spending has happened. And so we remain of a view that the large parts of the budget are inflationary, that it was a time for fiscal discipline and not for fiscal spending. And so we agree with many commentators that this was a blowout budget and not one that is going to anchor inflation and OCR and mortgage rates in a place that's good for New Zealanders in the near and medium term.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Carmel Cipollone, has claimed that your policy to raise the super age to 67 would mean that people could miss out on more than $50,000. Is this something that you would refute?
Is this something that we would have?
Refute, deny.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Carmel's wrong, I'm afraid, and she's not looking at the fiscal sustainability of the country as Treasury and many commentators have alluded to. The long-term sustainability of superannuation where it is at the moment is not tenable, particularly with the increasing age group. So we would struggle to see how that becomes a valid argument if we're looking at the long-term economic projections for the country.
Would National keep the winter energy payment as is?
Look, that's something I'd need to chat with our energy spokesperson and with our finance team So that's nothing I can give you clarity on here today, other than we are having discussions around the winter energy payment.
Moves to increase the retirement age in countries like France recently have seen widespread pushback and have caused significant problems for the country with mass striking. Do you anticipate that your policy would be popular among working people in Aotearoa?
Look, we understand that New Zealanders get the need for long-term financial viability and stability. So we think people will understand that certainly with the long lead-in that we're talking about to increase in superannuation, that New Zealanders will just see fiscally responsible, economically sound thinking around that. France and some of the European countries are quite different because their superannuation age is a good deal younger. There was some pushback in Australia, but certainly nothing in the European countries. And we have to remember that if we look across the ditch, we see a superannuation age that's different to ours. So while there'll be some that it may not resonate with, I think most New Zealanders will understand that need for long-term financial stability and fiscal discipline sensibly requires an increase in superannuation age over time, over a long transition period.
That was the National Party's Dr. Shane Reddy.
Classic journo question as well. Can I have a jaw?
The Wire.
Ta alofa lava, Manuele Vaiaso o Lingangana Samoa, Happy Samoan Language Week. To understand deeper what Samoan Language Week is all about, how Auckland universities are celebrating, and what Aotearoa should be doing to better preserve Samoan language and culture, I spoke to Rina, the Public Relations Officer for the University of Auckland Samoan Students Association, or UASA.
Tālofalava everyone and happy Samoan Language Week. I'm Rina, I'm one of WASA's PR officers for this year, and basically my role in WASA is just to promote our association and just try and invite people in. And yeah, we look forward to having you guys join with us for Samoan Language Week this week.
Awesome, thank you. I'd love if you could just elaborate a little bit more on what Samoan Language Week means to you as a young person and as someone that's involved with the Samoan community at UOA, and also what the theme this year means to you guys.
I'll just start off the theme. So the theme this year is Mitamitai lo ngangana maua I lo fa asinumanga, and it translates to be proud of your language and be grounded in your identity. And yeah, that theme speaks a lot to a lot of young Samoans in our generation because, you know, we're going through days where our language isn't really spoken as much and our culture isn't really practiced. So in order for us to be able to carry on our culture to future generations, it's really important that we stay grounded in our identity and keep the practice of Samoan language alive. And Samoan Language Week for me, growing up, it's something that I always look forward to because, you know, when else do we get to celebrate our culture? And not only that, it's the week leading up to the celebration of our Independence Day. So yeah, it's just something to be really proud of as a young Samoan, and something that we look forward to in preparations for, you know, WASA. It's something that it's a week where we get to express ourselves without, you know, feeling like, you know, we're doing too much. And yeah, so yeah, something to be really proud of.
Awesome. Thank you for that. I'm kind of interested to hear a little bit about how in New Zealand nowadays we can celebrate Samoan Language Week while also being mindful of quite different experiences amongst the Samoan New Zealander community. So regarding people that have lived in New Zealand all their life or have recently migrated from Samoa or have different relationships with their faith and spirituality or different levels of language fluency, how do we go about celebrating Samoan Language Week so that it's sensitive and still kind of open to everyone regardless of experience?
I think it's up to the individual and how they choose to celebrate it. I know you mentioned, you know, religion, and Samoa, our motto is Samoa is founded on God. So last night, WASA, we had a whainga lotu, so it's just an evening prayer session where everyone comes together, and it kind of reflected how in our Samoan families, every night we put time aside to give glory and thanks back to God.
I've been doing a little bit of reading about what's going on at UOA this week, and Monday marked the beginning of Samoan Language Week, and the university celebrated with a traditional Ava ceremony. Could you describe to our listeners who might not be familiar with these kind of ceremonies the importance of that and kind of what takes place?
the ceremony, traditionally it's used to welcome or to officiate our chiefs when they receive their chief titles, or when we welcome other visiting villagers into our homes. But nowadays it's more used for, you know, openings of certain ceremonies. So yeah, we use it to open Samoan language week, and it's a whole process of, behind it. Basically, it's the gist of Ava, so that's the cover root. And it's basically just to welcome those who are visiting us, so that once you've been welcomed into the Ava ceremony, you're no longer a stranger to us. It's a very sacred practice, and yeah, it's still being used to this day, so that's something that's really good about the Ava ceremony, is that the practice of Ava has never died.
Awesome. And then in terms of the students that are involved with Wasa, do you typically find that it's kind of tricky sometimes for such personal and intimate gatherings and events to bridge that gap between academic and family life, or are different families kind of invited to join in on such ceremonies, or is everyone kind of in Wasa really close-knit? How is the dynamic in terms of bridging academic and family life?
So one thing that our president and VP always tell us is Wasa is always a co-curricular activity, and it's not our, you know, a whole life. So we do prioritise our studies in Wasa. If we have, you know, an assignment due, but we also have a meeting or an event at Wasa, they will always make us prioritise our studies. And with our families do get involved with Wasa. They help out whenever they can with food prep, when we need stuff made for our members. And because at Wasa, we are already a family in itself, having our, you know, our actual family involved really enhances that whole, you know, community vibe and Samoan culture, and, yeah, just being interconnected with each other.
Thursday marks Samoan Independence Day, when the island became the first in the Pacific to gain independence from New Zealand. Do you find this is a day that brings up a lot of mixed emotions, especially amongst a younger generation of Samoans living in New Zealand?
Yeah, definitely mixed emotions. I know for a lot of us, we have ancestors that were involved in the event leading up to us becoming independent, which is what we did Black Saturday. Definitely, you know, our pride is in there, but leading up to this time, we do always reflect back on what our people went through to get us to where we are now, and, you know, what New Zealand put our people through. And, yeah, just a lot of mixed emotions for young Samoans living in New Zealand.
Finally, I just want to ask, I know that a lot of the events taking place at UOA this week and across the country are there to facilitate really important spaces for the Samoan community, but what would you want those outside of the Samoan community to be doing this week to participate in preserving Samoan culture and heritage and language?
Just for them to, you know, participate in our events. It's not just closed off to Samoans. But yeah, we would really like for, you know, non-Samoans to come witness our culture, participate with us and practice our culture with us. Even if they're just there to watch, just as long as they're getting a glimpse of our culture and, you know, who we are as Samoans. It's something as small as, you know, just sharing our phrases of the day or sharing posts from Samoan Language Week. We really love seeing that other cultures getting involved.
Awesome. Do you want to add any social media tags or anything else that you'd like to kind of say before we finish up?
Yes. So if you're not already following our Instagram page, it's at Wasa_UOA. We posted our agenda for this week. So if you're, you know, at the University of Auckland, or even if you're not and you want to get involved, feel free to come along. Tonight at 6 p.m. we have a Siva Samoa workshop down at the Whale. And yeah, we also have our big independent showcase this week on Thursday. Follow us on our Instagram page and stay posted with all our events.
That was Rina from Wasa. Next, I spoke to Jacobo Matabo, who is the first ever Pro Vice Chancellor for the Pacific at AUT. Jacobo has specialised in Pacific early childhood and educational research, so we spoke about preserving Samoan culture across different age demographics and the challenges facing young Samoan communities today.
Malo lavare soifua o lo inoria kauma matapo I sao maile nu o si umu Samoa o lo pina I sao maile nu o Samoa o lo tamai sao maile Leiden Holland yeah o ole tamai tai Samoa. So I'm just sharing with you my connections to Si Umu and Samoa, also my father's connection to Leiden Holland. I am the new Pro Vice Chancellor Pacific here at Auckland University of Technology.
Shall we just start off by talking a little bit about the theme this year and what it means to you personally?
Yeah, of course. So the theme, I mean, Samoa or Ngana Samoa is really at the heart of my very being, having ancestral ties and connections to Samoa. And the theme itself this year, you know, speaks to the significance of those cultural connections tied to the Ngana, to the language. For me personally as well, being New Zealand born, growing up in Aotearoa, the language has been a significant part of my childhood and my upbringing, but also that sense of struggle, you know, in terms of engaging in my own academic journey, obviously in English medium classroom spaces. So, you know, thinking about the revitalisation and sustaining of Samoan language is very much a personal one, but also a key aspect of what I would hope for in terms of our young Samoan people growing up in Aotearoa.
So you mentioned before that you're the Pro Vice-Chancellor Pacific for AUT and you're the first appointed in this role. Could you speak a little bit about what that means to you, being the first person in this role as a Samoan woman, and what the process was for getting this role recognised at AUT?
I guess it's huge in terms of seeing the capacity to support Pacific growth within the institution, but to come out the other side and then be appointed in a position of leadership to further contribute to new and emerging leaders in the space, but also to be involved and remain with those connections with Pacific community at AUT has meant a lot to me. So the previous position was an assistant vice-chancellor, so with the pro-vice-chancellor position, it's really exciting to actually push forward, you know, Pacific academic capabilities as well as growing Pacific research and, of course, you know, supporting with the whole student journey. So it's seeing it right from, you know, recruitment all the way to the success of our alumni.
I'd love to talk a little bit about your experience working with younger children as well as students and what sounds to be a wide age range of Pacifica and Samoans. And I'd love to hear a little bit about the range of different perspectives on Samoan culture and how across different age demographics one's connection with their own culture and heritage can kind of change, and how you feel about that across different age groups.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, because we understand that, you know, language is something that even in even during pregnancy that children are exposed to, you know, and I also draw from, you know, early childhood education scholarship, which tells us about the importance of, you know, supporting and sustaining a strong heritage language foundation for the future success of our young Pacific people. You know, there are New Zealand Pacific scholars who have written extensively about this, but also in terms of having secure cultural identity and cultural well-being, you know, as a vehicle for success even later on in life, you know, through the sort of more formative education years. You know, in New Zealand, from the last census, we understand that Samoan's population in New Zealand is around, you know, 3.9%. So Samoan population is the larger proportion of the Pacific demographics across Aotearoa. You know, and also Samoan language back in the, you know, 2018 census data tells us that it was the third most spoken language. But, you know, in a recent report presented by MPP, you know, it was stated as well that actually, you know, the language is actually dropping. So there's a decline in the language use for Samoan. particularly for the younger generations of Samoan growing up. So these are all part of the conversation. You know, language is one part of it, but also, I guess, understanding how important language is in terms of holding the cultural knowledge and cultural heritage.
So a big part of this week, obviously, is Thursday, which is Samoan Independence Day. How would you say we need to go about educating future generations and also reflecting on a long and complex history between New Zealand and Samoa in a way that is critical but also sensitive and all-encompassing of different perspectives?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't too long ago that we had the Prime Minister Fiumea visiting New Zealand, you know, commemorating the 60 years of friendship with New Zealand and realising that New Zealand, you know, actually does have a rich history in terms of this treaty friendship with Samoa, and that those networks and relations have continued over years and have evolved over years, and realising too that many Samoan community members continue to support and sustain, you know, these transnational relationships across Aotearoa, New Zealand and Samoa. In terms of New Zealand Samoan community, in terms of how we can strengthen and sustain language and culture, I think, you know, things like celebrating Samoan Language Week is a really good place to start. You know, thinking about ways in which in our workplaces, in our various contexts that we engage, opening spaces to learn more about the culture and the importance of the language and identity for Samoan people. Also realising too that, you know, not all Samoans can speak fluent in Ngangana Samoa. So, you know, thinking about ways in which, you know, Samoan people are on their own language journey, it's definitely multifaceted and dynamic. You know, thinking about ways in which we can, as Samoan people, preserve our culture, you know, activate, you know, cultural practices in a space that is not necessarily our ancestral lands.
That was Jakapa Matapu, Pro Vice Chancellor Pacific from AUT.
We'll be back right after this short break. You are listening to The Wire on 95BFM.
Time is running out to complete the 2023 census. If you haven't done it yet, you have until the end of June. It's your last chance to be counted and help make a difference to your community. Call 0800 Census, that's 0800 236 787, or visit www.census.govt.nz to get started now. Tatou tātou, all of us count.
Oh, hey.
Bloody hell, mate.
Hey.
G'day, haven't seen you around for ages. What have you been up to?
Yeah, just been real bogged down thinking about space.
Oh, like planets and black holes and stuff?
Yeah, quasars, asteroids, really all the space stuff.
Oh, yeah, so that's your new job now? Like at the observatory?
Nah, just been thinking about it. It's taken me ages, though. It's big ass.
Okay. Yeah.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday, only on 95BFM Drive. Here in the twilight.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mo tēnei wiki nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Joel Rindlob, who will be sorely missed, Dr. Shane Reddy and Dr. Oliver Hartwich. Thanks to Rina from Uasa and Jakubu Matopo for speaking on Samoan Language Week.
And thanks to James Shaw and climate activist India Logan Riley for their comments on the Climate Change March last Friday.
Nei rā hoki, te mihi, kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You are listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Jin for some bangers. And I'm going to leave you with a song for my late granddad who passed away last week. So enjoy.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.